Before we get started, I thought this was probably good to share with you from time to time. Advice from an old farmer. Your fences need to be horse high, pig tight, and bull strong. Y'all have probably heard that one before. And one more, and this is the advice from an old farmer. Keep skunks and bankers at a distance. Now, I figured we would share that because there's no sense in the lawyers always getting run down. So, but we're going to get started with our class. And when Billy approached me about working with him on this topic, face-to-face with Jesus, if you weren't here last week, he began the first installment with John the Baptizer. And what a great way to start it. And Brother Billy always does great at in our Bible classes. And my first thought when he presented this to me was the face-to-face meetings that Moses had with God. But did he really? So he was in his presence. He was on holy ground. It was told to him on one occasion. How exciting that must have been. That's not even a good description. Heart pounding. I can just imagine if it were me, I would be having a hard time catching my breath, hyperventilating. And so, and it stood out to me, there's one verse in Exodus 33, if you'd like to look there. And what stood out to me is in the context of face to face with Jesus, and we even sing an old standby hymn, written by Fanny Crosby, "He hideth my soul in the cleft of the rock." No doubt, Exodus 33 may have been an inspiration for that song. In verse 17, we read this. Well, and get this part. In verse 11, before we get to verse 17, the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a friend. And just hold that in your thoughts as we read verse 17. And the Lord said to Moses, "I will do this thing of which you have spoken." You can read back a little few verses to get the full context. "For you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by name." Then Moses said, "I pray thee, show me thy glory." Now, what in the world does that mean, actually? How would you define that? When I read the next statement and the description of the story, I picture some image of a giant personification of God. But at the same time, it seems God is describing something not as much physical, but spiritual and or prophetic. See what you think. Verse 19, "I myself will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I will show compassion on whom I will show compassion." But he said, "You cannot see me or see my face, for no man can see me and live." Verse 21, "Then the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me, and you shall stand there on the rock. And it will come about while my glory is passing by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by." How big must that hand have been? "Then I will take my hand away and you will see my back, but my face shall not be seen." Face to face with Jesus, face to face with God. For the casual Bible reader, this may simply be classified as interesting. Much like they must have thought when Jesus told parables. That was interesting, but what did that mean? What an amazing glimpse, a little glimpse into how far this goes into the revelation by Christ in the gospel, the good news. What God told Moses was a law. It was solid. "No man can see me and live." And even John wrote in John 1 and 18, "No man has seen God at any time. The only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, He has, King James, declared him. New American Standard, explained him. So it was a law. It means certain death, which all started with Adam and Eve's sin in the garden. Before that sin, what impression do we have in the garden? Face to face with God, right? It just makes sense. He was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. But Adam and Eve, after they sinned, they hid their faces. I can just imagine they wouldn't even raise their eyebrows to look upon him. And so the premise behind face-to-face study, in my mind, in its simplest form, and sometimes you just have to boil it down to the simplest form, what would it really be like to be face-to-face with Jesus? Now, we don't have to speculate about that completely. And a side note, how many times in your lives have you thought or prayed for God to just show you which direction you should go? That's a rhetorical question, right? Every one of us have probably been in that position. Just show me. Which way? What do I do? Job opportunities. Maybe you had multiple opportunities at the same time. Which job do you choose? Which place is going to be more compatible with you? Which one is going to teach you more or lead you to a better income? What's going to be better for your family? What about when you were dating or when you were spouse hunting? Which one? Which person? I've got a few options here. Who should I choose? Which one is going to be the best family member and builder with me? What about house hunting? Where are you going to live? Property values are likely to go down if I choose the wrong one. Schools to choose for your children. Am I going to ruin my children by allowing them to go to this school or that school? Wouldn't it have been great for God to just speak up and answer our questions, to give us some advice? Well, be careful what you ask for. The children of Israel learned quickly in Exodus 20. They didn't even want to hear his voice, let alone get some advice from him. Exodus 20, verse 18, "And all the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance." I want to kind of get a mental image of how far was that. When it's that rumbling and powerful, how far away did they stand? Anyway, that's my mind. Verse 19, then they said to Moses, "Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but let not God speak to us lest we die." You're probably familiar with this same chapter, Exodus 20. That earlier in the chapter, God established the Ten Commandments. That kind of gives us a context, doesn't it? Establishing the law. How much advice did they want to hear directly from God? So be careful what you ask for. And all of that brings us to the one face-to-face meeting with Jesus that I'm fascinated with, that I want to present to you today, and that is the Samaritan woman at the well. If you want to be turning to John chapter 4 and put a mark there, Kaufman summarizes the history of Samaria, which I think it's important for us to grasp a little bit for this story, and references back to 2 Kings chapter 17. But in his commentary, he said this caption for concerning the woman of Samaria: "The tragic story of the Samaritans and the contempt in which that unfortunate people were held by the Jews endow this incident with the deepest interest. Following the capture of the 10 northern tribes by Shalmaneser in 722 BC, the cities and the villages of Samaria were totally depopulated and left to the wild beasts. Not wishing to let the land lie idle, the king of Assyria repopulated the area with people from Babylon, Cutta, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, easy for me to say. And so you can look at 2 Kings 17 and 31 as a little side note about those people that you can't say the name. The Sepharvites burned their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. You might compare this king's action to the repopulating of our nation in our time. The nation changes to something unrecognizable if you don't keep control of it. Sometimes a people with different morals or different standards will change that nation. Kaufman mentioned this same thing in his summary. Of course, they brought their old idol worship with them, but they were introduced to the Jewish scriptures in the following manner. The people were troubled by the marauding wild beasts. The lions were mentioned in 2 Kings. And the king of Assyria decided that the trouble might have been due to the new settlers having neglected the God of the land. So he dispatched one of the captive priests of Israel to enlighten the people, and thus the Samaritans came into possession of the Pentateuch, the only part of the Hebrew Bible which they accepted. They set up a system of religion based partially upon the Pentateuch, but containing also a number of foreign elements. And there you have it. And there is a prejudice that is established, if for no other reason, for what we just read. And so the prejudice of the Jews that they had for the Samaritans was well known. And I highlighted the fact that some of them burned their own children to their false gods. Can you understand, if you put yourselves in the Jews' shoes, why they despise the Samaritans so much? And so there is the basis for the background for this story. And so Jesus approached the well of Jacob, as labeled by John, the Apostle John, and by the Samaritan woman herself, no doubt knowing all this history, you see. All this animosity and downright hatred and the despicable treatment placed on the descendants of the Samaritans now living in Jesus' day. And so there you have your background. And don't you think that Jesus had all of these things in mind? Maybe he even had in mind Ezekiel chapter 18 when the word of the Lord came to him saying in verses 1 through 9, "What do you mean by using this proverb concerning the land of Israel? The fathers eat the sour grapes, but the children's teeth are set on edge. As I live," now how important was it? "By the eternal nature of God, as he lives, you are surely not going to use this proverb in Israel anymore. Verse 4, "Behold, all souls are mine. The soul of the father as well as the soul of the son is mine. The soul who sins will die. But if a man is righteous and practices justice and righteousness," and then after verse 5 he goes into a list of violations, but jump down to verse 9, "if he walks in my statutes and my ordinances so as to deal faithfully, he is righteous and will surely live, declares the Lord." So sour grapes eaten by the dad, children's teeth are set on edge. What that means, of course, is just because there's an evil father, or if he sins, that does not force the child to follow in the path of those sins. And so, with all that, the stage is set. We're ready for John chapter 4. This face-to-face with Jesus. Verse 1 through 6. "When therefore the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself was not baptizing, but his disciples were, he left Judea, departed again into Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria." I like the way John worded that. He had to pass through Samaria. No, he didn't. The Jews bypassed it all the time, didn't they? And then verse 5, "So he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, was sitting thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour." Now, not to get too deep in the weeds, there's a debate on what time of day that means. Without getting too deep into it, And I believe, as others do, that this was about noon. And the chosen, you might be thinking about, they referenced it as noon of the noon hour. But that being said, Jesus arrived before the Samaritan woman, according to John. So perfect timing, but he is the Son of God after all. So imagine if you could just time it any better than he did. Look at John 4, verse 7. Therefore came a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And I can't help but throw in here, this reads to Ronnie Kephart in the 21st century, a little bit cold, on the cold side. Give me a drink. You know, and I know that's not the way he said it, but it sort of sounds that way as you're reading it. And I have to think about the context, and the context of their face-to-face changes my opinion immediately. It also helps to see the depiction of this scene as told by the series The Chosen, where Jesus was shown to say, I should have said please. So I thought that was a nice touch. Now, are you like I am? Do you see a little sassiness in the Samaritan woman when she's at the well and talking with Jesus? I saw some nods, so I think maybe you see somebody who's not willing to just be rolled over. She didn't just abide by Jesus' request for a drink of water. She didn't say no either, but she was no dummy. Listen to her pushback, verse 9. The Samaritan woman therefore said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink since I am a Samaritan woman?" The writer John reveals to us in a parenthetical statement, if you will, "For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Now it occurs to me this was double jeopardy. Not only was she a Samaritan, but she was a woman. In that day, that might have been the way she would, or that would have been said. And so is her reaction understandable? Her pushback? After studying the history between the Jews and the Samaritans, yeah, probably very understandable. It was even said that when the temple reconstruction was ready to begin, the Samaritans offered to help, but the Jews wouldn't have any part of their help. Her reaction then was expected. But get ready to be taken to school, Samaritan woman at the well. And I don't mean that Jesus is going to chastise her in any way, but her eyes are about to be opened. And so, verse 10, Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." How deep is that? She said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water? You are not greater than our father Jacob, are you, who gave us the well and drank of it himself and his sons and his cattle?" Take a second for an observation. Have you ever considered the gifts that you received or that you have given? What kind of impact have they made on the gift receiver? Now, I mean, think about it. Sometimes we struggle, don't we, for a family get-together, family Christmas or whatever, and you're going to give gifts, and you say, "Oh, I don't know what to get them. Brother Billy has everything he wants. He buys it himself. What are you going to get him? He's got everything he needs." So you get a gift card. "Oh, that was nice. That was a big impact. I can go to Home Depot or wherever now." But really, was it very impactful, you see? And so this Samaritan woman, who is nameless as far as I know, made an excellent point about Jesus' impact on others in Jesus' lifetime, as far as she could understand, you see. And so the question came to me, how old is 30? Do you know what I mean by that? So aside from the number of years and weeks and months that it adds up to, how old is 30 compared to 50 and 60 or 100? Now, I'm approaching 60 in less than 2 years, and there are some brothers and sisters, no offense taken, in the congregation who have said that I was a young man. You know, I was still a baby. You know, in other words, I haven't experienced as many things as they have, and I get it. That's exactly right. It's all about perspective, you see. This woman's perspective of Jesus was a young man, 30-something-year-old man. And if Jesus was in his early 30s at this point, regardless of her age, maybe she was even older than Jesus, considering her experiences with men. He looked too young in her eyes to have had much impact on others in comparison to Jacob. That's interesting to me. What if Jesus seemed a baby by comparison to her? As if you haven't lived yet. There's no way you could be able to outdo our father Jacob. After all, this well wasn't drilled with a diamond tip auger. You know, this thing wasn't done with machinery and done rather quickly by comparison. Jacob gave us this well. It was a gift. How long had it been since Jacob dug this well? And she made the even deeper point that generations of people and cattle had benefited from Jacob's gift. How much greater could Jesus be than Jacob in his early 30s? You see, that's the point of view I see from the eyes of the Samaritan woman. And as the 40-year-old guy that does the life hack videos, you know, you mean I've lived 40 years and I could have been doing it this way? Ain't no way. Because can't you imagine? That's what she's saying. There's no way you have that much impact. Well, let's get back to the passage. Verse 13, Jesus answered and said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water shall thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life." Wow. What a mouthful that our Lord just rattled off to her. I suspect she wasn't ready to hear all of that, you think? So it might be helpful here to read the next statement that she makes with a little bit of tongue-in-cheek. Verse 15, "Sir, give me this water so I will not be thirsty nor come all the way here to draw." Now, I've always read this story with Jesus face-to-face with the Samaritan woman at the well. I just read it at face value, as if this woman was being serious when she said that statement. "Sure, I'll take some of that water that gives me eternal life. I believe you, perfect stranger, you Jew, man, there's no way I'm going to believe that." And on the contrary, from reading it face value, surely at this point, she has nothing to build her faith on. How long has she been talking to him? 2 minutes? I mean, we don't know, but we're just having to gauge by how many words were said and how long it took them to say these. And how is she going to have faith in this snake oil salesman that she just met, who's a young man in her eyes? How long has this conversation been going on? Not long enough to have developed much faith. The Chosen series, rightfully so, in my view, even depicted this Samaritan woman to say, "Prove it," at one point. I see that better now. I agree with this portrayal, and Jesus spoke some crazy claims in her mind so far, too crazy to believe yet. So here comes the proof. Here comes her eye-opening education. Verse 16, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered and said, "I have no husband." Did she expect his next answer back to her? "You have well said, I have no husband." Verse 18, "For you have had five husbands, and the one whom you have now or now have is not your husband. "This you have said truly." I dare say the Samaritan woman at the well, when she heard Jesus tell her the number of husbands that she had after this face-to-face had been going on for, let's give them 5 to 10 minutes. I dare say that she didn't respond like a 14-year-old reading Shakespeare plays in class off of the script. And I say that to give kudos to my English teacher who used to be a native of Montgomery, Mrs. Julia Gregg. And I can just imagine how sad we sounded reading those scripts in her class in a circle. You know, okay, you've got Macbeth and you've got so-and-so and you read the next line. And can you imagine the 14-year-olds trying to read that with some emphasis? Nah. Her reaction was maybe more like Ferris Bueller's teacher calling roll at the start of class. Bueller, Ferris Bueller. No, she was probably more excited than that, you see. Verse 19, the woman said, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." And later Jesus was asked his disciples or his apostles, "Who do men say that I am?" Some said a prophet, right? Remember, we established this woman was no dummy. Listen to the next part of the conversation. Don't you imagine she wanted to talk to a Jew, let alone a prophet, for a long time, just by the words she's about to use? So here's my chance. She's going to get a chance to speak to a prophet about this issue that she has dealt with and thought was unfair for a long time. Verse 20, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say," I like that, "you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." So in other words, in my view, she's saying, let's get this debate started. I've been wanting to debate this a long time. And Jesus actually gives her a great deal of credit for her argument. Imagine the everyday God-fearing Samaritan who was much like this woman and questioning, why is this, why is that? What kind of God restricted him from worshiping according to the law of Moses because he was not allowed to sacrifice at the temple in Jerusalem? Banned from the only true worship they knew under the law of Moses. So let's get back. Verse 21. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall you worship the Father." Just wait, he's saying. But Jesus continues, "You worship that which you do not know. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and truth, for such people the Father seeks to be his worshipers." And here's the kicker, isn't it? God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Just powerful. How true it had been said about Jesus of Nazareth in Matthew 7 after his Sermon on the Mount. Here was the result. The result was that when Jesus had finished these words, the multitudes were amazed at his teaching. For he was teaching them as one having authority, not like Ronnie Kephart who has to point to this and that. He was teaching with authority, not as their scribes. The debate between the Samaritan and the woman and Jesus continues. Verse 25. The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When that one comes, he will declare all things to us." So she's still thinking, this is a prophet. I've got a prime opportunity, but this is still just a prophet. Can you say that, just a prophet? And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." What do you think her facial reaction was then? Again, we have questions regarding this conversation. Questions are good. Does the conversation stand as an exhaustive quotation of what was said? Did John give us all that was said in this face-to-face, or just enough to get the point across? I shake my head this way. I honestly don't know, though, but I find this great woman of the Bible developed her faith rather quickly at merely words spoken by a complete stranger. In her mind, this was a chance encounter until it wasn't. Just a prophet until he wasn't just a prophet. Was this a face-to-face merely because Jesus was tired and thirsty? Think about what he has just revealed to this woman. Who else knew? His apostles? But who else? Remember, we're in John chapter 4. One of the most famous conversations known in the Christendom, right? But a more famous Bible verse is in the previous chapter, John 3 and verse 16. What character is revealed to us in John 3? So we know Nicodemus was a believer of Jesus, but secretly for fear of his fellow Pharisees. He arranged a secret meeting with Jesus at night. John tells us that conversation in John chapter 3. When Nicodemus starts the conversation, I wonder what he hoped Jesus would say in response. Listen to this. Verse 2. This man came to him by night and said to him, "Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher, for no one can do these signs, miracles, that you do unless God is with him." And here John gives us a comparison, in my view, between two face-to-face meetings that Jesus had. Nicodemus was an actual ruler of the Jews. That's a significant statement given to us. Catalog that in the back of your minds as we compare Jesus face-to-face with Nicodemus and the one in the next chapter with the Samaritan woman at the well. What did Nicodemus hope to hear from Jesus? Was this his best pickup line or hook to get Jesus to share with him? A ruler of the Jews, rabbi, we know that you must be from God. Had he possibly rehearsed what in the world he would say when the meeting time arrived? I imagine he went over it with a fine-tooth comb. What do I say? What do I say? What would be the first statement you'd make or question that you'd ask if you were Nicodemus and you were a ruler of the Jews? And don't forget, at that point, Nicodemus had little to no information about Jesus like we do today. Surely he had seen or believed reports of miracles performed, but what could he have really known at that point? It's early. Surely Nicodemus expected a face-to-face with Messiah, if that's who he was. What he expected would have included how to succeed against the Roman Empire. When would that time of freedom come? Don't you think those are some questions that he hoped to hear answers to? How would that revolt be organized if Messiah comes to lead us back to power? Yet Jesus turned it around, and he made the statement about being born again, born of water, the way a man can be justified in his kingdom. That's what he talked about instead of the Roman Empire or power or whatever. He gave this ruler of the Jews the most famous scripture in the history of the world, possibly. But Nicodemus got a puzzle, a riddle, in a sense, to his questions. The Samaritan woman, a Gentile, was given an answer to a long-awaited question about worship. Goodness, that's some good stuff there. Nicodemus was teasing Jesus for an answer to who he was. The Samaritan woman received the affirmation, "I am the Messiah." Is that interesting, the comparison between these two? Jesus was thirsty. He needed a drink and some food. However, he was there to begin the fulfillment of the promise of Abraham, made to Abraham, Genesis 26 and 4, and others. All nations will be blessed through his seed, Abraham's seed, and that offspring of Abraham was finally here. And who did Jesus tell? And the first one in the general public to hear it was was this lowly Samaritan woman who was not even a great candidate for that. You want equality? You want equity? God did that 2,000 years ago. Christianity has been the biggest liberator of women and slaves and to put aside things that are wrong to human beings more than any other thing or entity in history. Let's move on to verse 27. And at that point, his disciples came. And they marveled that he had been speaking with a woman, yet no one said, "What do you seek?" or "Why do you speak with her?" So the woman left her water pot and went into the city and said to the men, "Come see a man who told me all the things that I have done. This is not the Christ, is it?" Then they went out of the city and were coming to him. Now, there are so many things John didn't have room to write about this story. The timeline is not oblivious to me. I know a significant amount of time was needed for the disciples to travel further into town for food and return. This face-to-face with Jesus could have had much more conversation to it, and likely did. After all, she said Jesus told her all that she had done, and John only reveals her marriages and implied promiscuity. Was there more? I don't know, but it's sure interesting. It is assumed in this story that the Samaritan woman probably didn't have or wouldn't have been well received by her own people. Yet she was so convinced and so convincing that she persuaded the men of the city to leave the city and in the middle of the day and go out to see Jesus. How convinced are we? And then how convincing could we be, depending on that reaction? No one was raised from the dead that I read about. There was no outward physical miracles performed that I know of. But a revelation a long time in coming was told to the most unsuspecting person in the known world. Could he have chosen a better person? Somebody could say, yeah, easily. And that gives me hope for my face-to-face with Jesus when this life is over. Redeemed, how I love to proclaim it, redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. Can't you just imagine what it's going to be like? No man can see me and live. Hold on to that thought. More about that as we continue on. I hope the class has been helpful to you. I may be a minute or two early, but that's good enough. I don't have any more notes. And I appreciate your attention. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.